Late Friday night, President Obama signed an order calling for $85 billion in federal budget cuts, collectively known as sequestration. There's been a lot of speculation about the impact of cuts on the military and entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security, but the cuts will affect every aspect of the federal budget, including funding for science. Scientific research and technological innovation are cornerstones of President Obama's plans for economic recovery. Of course, government labs, academic research institutions, and private sector tech companies are also major players in the CAPES economy. So today we're taking a look at the role science plays in our economy and how the sequester will impact that. By one estimate, R&D stands to take a $15 billion hit. That estimate comes from Chris Martinson, a neurotoxicologist turned economist and founder of peakprosperity.com. Chris joins me by phone from his home in Western Massachusetts. Welcome, Chris.
It's good to be here, Heather.
We'll also be checking in with some of our local science institutions later in the show. And of course, we welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 866-999-4626. Email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or find us on Twitter. Now, Chris, $15 billion is a big number. That's 17.5% of the total $85 billion in cuts under sequestration. How did you arrive at that figure?
Well, Heather, I've got a lot more detail on it now because the early numbers that we were working with have been refined a little bit. The OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, put out a very detailed 83-page report on Friday afternoon. So I've had the opportunity this weekend to look through it, and we've got some pretty good detail there if you would like to go into that.
Absolutely. Yeah, walk us through. What are these hits that science is going to take? What do they look like?
Well, let's start at the high level. The sequestration cuts, it's $85 billion, and that's split evenly between defense and non-defense. So that's $42.5 billion to each of those sectors. Various portions of both defense and non-defense were considered to be exempt. So the $42.5 billion actually falls upon the remaining portions of each that were, in the parlance of government accounting, non-exempt. Does this make sense so far?
I think I'm still with you.
Okay, well, because these cuts have to be accomplished over the remaining 7 months of the fiscal year rather than the full 12 months, the effective reductions are going to be actually fairly high, as much as 13% for defense and 9% for non-defense. And so when we comb through this, it looks like of the $42 billion that falls to non-defense, $11 billion of that falls to Medicare. So we have $31 billion that has to be saved from everything else. That's every other department from the executive down through special programs. Now, what we do know at this point, we know how much falls to each department, at least according to the OMB high-level cuts. And we have that first-level pass from the OMB at how much should come from even each program running within each department. What we don't know is how each department is actually going to apportion the cuts within and across the various programs that they're running.
Okay, so we've got this broad picture of where sequestration cuts are going to fall. How does that then translate into cuts for research funding, or and then how does that also impact the private sector R&D?
Okay, well, what I did was I went line by line through the whole document and found those portions of the budgets within the NSF, the NIH, FDA, CDC, Department of Energy, NASA, and the EPA, and discovered that there's around $3 billion in cuts that are specifically associated with line items that say science in them, or technology, or something like that. And what we don't know, again, is how much of those cuts are actually going to fall within various programs, because there's a lot of moving parts here. There's going to be some difficulty for the programs to figure out how they're going to be able to save this amount of money. It's actually a fairly large amount of money, given where we are in this type of year. That $3 billion is all out of government budgets. We don't know how much of that flows to academia and to the private sector at this point. As you know, a lot of NSF, NIH budgets do flow through in grants to academia. The private sector supplies a lot of the material, supplies, reagents that are going to be contained within many of those grants. How this is all going to flow through, we don't know, but the high-level pass right now is around $3 billion direct hit to science over the next 7 months.
So that $3 billion, you were saying that falls out to be about, is that 9% is what you were saying of the science budget?
Yep, that falls out. It's about 9% of those various budgets as the 9% from this moment forward. It should have been around 5% of the full year budget, but here we are, you know, with just 7 months left.
Okay, so that's $3 billion. How do we get from the $3 billion in line item cuts in the sequester bill to this $15 billion hit to R&D?
Well, there's the other thing that's going to be happening here is this is just direct spending cuts that we're talking about with sequestration. There are a lot of ways that research and development is also supported outside of sequestration through tax credits and other tax pieces, many of which have not been taken at this point in time. So we've got credits across all sorts of renewable technologies, R&D technologies, all over the place. Those have not yet been renewed as well. It's going to have a fairly large ripple effect. This $3 billion is in direct cuts. Of course, that there's other funding that then flows from that. So if $3 billion flows from the government into academia and into private industry, that is then levered up with spending at those levels, much of which might be put on hold at least for a while, and some of it will actually be cut.
Now, obviously, this could be quite painful for scientists in government labs, in academia, and even in the private sector. But when will the public feel this, or will the public ever feel the impacts of these cuts to science?
Well, there's two primary ways that the funding cuts are going to be made. One is to direct costs and program funding. So, as I mentioned before, that might be supplies, equipment, materials, reagents, what have you, that are a portion of grant funding. This one's tricky to find any cuts in any grants that are already administered because of how funding flows. Many times the grants issued and supply costs are the first out the door to get the research up and running. And some research is just not amenable to being halted or delayed, such as human trials that are already in the clinic. The other main way to cut costs is through salaries. And by law, the government's constrained in two ways here. The first, government cannot reduce salaries or wages. And second, if they're going to accomplish any staff savings, it's through furloughs, and those reductions require 30 days' notice be sent first. So the impacts are not likely to be announced for some weeks yet as the details are sorted through, and then the bulk of the savings are probably going to come through furloughs, which have to be at least 30 days after that. So I'm going to think somewhere around mid-April, possibly early May, is the first that we would notice these. The public will notice these in the form of furloughs. We've already seen some news out that the Department of Defense on their side has furloughed many thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of civilian workers as a means to affect their cost savings.
Now, NPR's Science Friday on Friday also took a look at this issue. They had a guest from the City University of New York who said, science is really very unique. When you do things like furloughs or have to make these cuts, we're going to see programs and people go away that will not come back. Whether these, you know, cuts last for just a matter of months or not, the impacts will be permanent. Is science different from other sectors of the economy, and will it be disproportionately impacted by sequestration, do you think?
Well, it's absolutely a fair concern. When you do remove funding or support from an area, people within that area tend to look at their options, and many of them, once they gravitate away, will find other opportunities elsewhere. It might be in a different line of science. It might be in private industry. It might be in a different line of work altogether. In my own case, when I came out of my postdoctoral experience, I found a very, very poor job environment at that time in the late 90s, and wandered off into the world of business for a while. So I'm sensitive to the dynamic, and it's absolutely true that you know, the amount of funding that we have available in this country for science is it's a relatively modest amount compared to the size of our economy, and that sense of prioritization, what our country really values, is something that sequestration, I think, sends a poor signal. And let's be clear about this. This was self-created. Congress had a year and a half to think about, weigh, and potentially avoid these sequestration cuts. They did not sneak up on us at all, and yet here they are being administered, and probably what was designed to be a fairly blunt, fairly painful sort of a way, and it's happening. So that sends a signal. It absolutely does.
Certainly does. I mean, as we said before, scientific research, technological innovation is something that President Obama has tried to prioritize, but it's not necessarily clear that has filtered through to other sectors of the government at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, we also here on Cape Cod have a very science-heavy economy. Of course, we have the Woods Hole scientific community here where WCAI is located, but there are research reserves, national parks, there are other research institutions. How does science play into the broader economy in a more general sense, not just in terms of sequestration?
Well, science and technology are just absolutely essential to our future. And we have so many predicaments that are going to require our best creativity, our best people. For example, in the field of energy, if we really want to lean more heavily on solar and wind in the future, we absolutely have to crack the issue of how we're going to store that electricity. And we just don't have any workable, scalable solutions there yet. And so in just the field of energy, which is an area I specialize in quite a bit and look at, the role of science absolutely in technology cannot be overestimated. We absolutely need much more spending in this area. We're being absolutely left behind by other countries, China in particular, in these regards. And so our competitiveness, our future growth, also all of our future hopes and dreams really depend on leveraging technology, leveraging science, assuring that we have the best and the brightest working in those fields. And as you know, one of the large trends has been that we've had many, many extremely bright people gravitate towards and work in the fields of finance, not direct science. And they're brilliant people, and now they're busy coding complex algorithms to help computers battle each other a little bit more sophisticatedly and elegantly. And that's wonderful, I guess, from a finance perspective. But in terms of the long-term growth and engine of productivity in our society, those are not truly productive areas as basic science and research have proven to be and will continue to be.
Now, of course, as I mentioned, the Cape has a very science-heavy economy, and we do want to check in with some of our local institutions. Chris, please stay with us. We're going to bring in some other people to our conversation. With us now is Susan Avery, the director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Glad to have you, Susan.
Glad to be here.
Now, you issued a statement last week about the potential impacts of the sequester, and you had some interesting insights regarding the number of line items that different science funding bodies have in the budget and how that will play out in terms of different institutions and different labs' ability to weather sequestration.
That's true, and that's what lends itself to the uncertainty in planning to see what the impacts are going to be, actually, per agency and for the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Basically, the sequestration is applied across every single budget line in an agency's budget. So if you have many, many budget lines, all of them would be receiving this cut. If you have aggregated budget lines, the agency would have a little bit more flexibility in that budget line to put perhaps money, not to put the cuts across all, across equally across all of the projects that might be in that agency. So NOAA has a lot of budget items in its annual budget. NSF does not, nor does NASA really. So NSF and NASA inherently will have a little bit more flexibility internally to deal with that budget cuts and where they want to put it and where they don't want to put it, whereas NOAA will not have as much flexibility.
Now, obviously, that's potentially good news for an institution like the Oceanographic that does see a lot of NSF and NASA funding. But I'm also curious, you also have a lot of Navy and Office of Naval Research and Department of Defense funding that comes in for some of the engineering work that's done at the Oceanographic Institution. So how do you expect some of those defense cuts to filter through to research?
It's not clear right now. You know, the DoD budget is very massive and complex. They have a lot of large contracts and with associated employment economic implications. And there was a discussion going on to grant its limited discretion in prioritizing its funding cuts. I don't know if that's going to materialize or not. So we're watching ONR very carefully at this point.
Obviously, it's very early days yet, but can you give us a sense, do you expect this to mean the loss of jobs for the Oceanographic? And what is your institution doing to prepare, if so?
Okay, so given the uncertainty, it's very, very difficult to project. So what we are doing institution-wise is watching very carefully the project funding that we're receiving, how we're costing it out, and probably will have to be revising our budget, if not once, maybe even twice during this year in order to accommodate this changing environment that we're in. and the uncertainty environment that we're in. Can I promise that there won't be job layoffs? No. depending on how this all plays out in the agency by agency framework, that will determine if we need to lay off people or not. Right now, we would hope we wouldn't have to, at least for the first year. The fact that the National Science Foundation is not taking back projects that I've already been funding, we know what those are. The real implications for us might be not so much immediate, but next year.
Right. And I have seen a lot of analysts speculating that younger scientists and new projects will be taking the heaviest hit. They'll feel the burden of this more than the ongoing projects. But I'm curious, you know, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the Marine Biological Lab, are very much dependent on government funding, private funding, and don't really have the same tenure structure to support their faculty that, say, a major research university would have. So perhaps those ongoing projects and more senior faculty have less protection. Do you expect to see this disparity between younger scientists and more senior scientists here in Woods Hole?
I don't expect to see that right now, given what I've seen from NSF's letter saying that they would be protecting the grants that are in place right now. It will be impacting the competitive cycle this year. I don't necessarily see an age discrepancy right now, but I'll just have to wait and see.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your insights. We're going to keep moving and check in with a few other spots this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, we did check in with some of the other labs in Woods Hole late last week. Bill Karp, the director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, has said that he's still not sure how things are going to play out. And as a government lab, he's not quite able to speak publicly about this yet. Similarly, the Marine Biological Lab issued a very brief statement, a one-line statement, simply saying, quote, "It's too soon to know how this will affect the MBL, but we're watching the situation closely." So, Chris Martinson, we're still very much in the early days. Do we have any sense how long this might last? You were saying we probably won't feel the impacts until May. Will this even still be an issue in May?
Well, anything's possible at this point. We've seen the government walk up to various cliffs. We had the so-called fiscal cliff. We've had various brinksmanship episodes along the way. And so one line of thought is thinking that we've gotten ourselves to this point, but that somehow this will be avoided as well. That's always a possibility. But given the political nature of the situation in Washington right now, it looks like the sequestration is pretty much a done deal at this point. The machinery is already in motion. And it's not clear to me that we're going to be able to step away from this one before many of these very real impacts that Susan just articulated and other people have talked about. They're probably going to bite at this point in time. So my assessment is that we're going to have the sequestration, you know, from a macro perspective, when we look at $85 billion against the context of $3.5 trillion of spending, it doesn't look like that much. But as we go through the details, we discover that a huge, huge portion of that $3.5 trillion is mandatory spending that goes out the door no matter what, and that the true impact on discretionary funding is actually fairly pronounced.
One place that Cape Cod residents are almost certain to feel this impact is at the Cape Cod National Seashore. This is one of the top 10 visited national parks in the country, and the National Park Service has already issued a statement saying that Provincelands Visitor Center will be closed for the season due to the inability to staff and maintain it, and that in addition, large sections of the Great Beach will be have restricted access in order to protect the nesting shorebirds that live there, because, of course, the shorebirds require daily monitoring, and they won't be able to staff that. Joining us now for a little chat about what's going on at the seashore is Jason Taylor. He is the Chief of Natural Resources. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. Good morning.
Now, obviously, we're looking at some staffing reductions at the National Seashore, which will mean some reductions in public access. But the seashore is also an important base for some long-term and other environmental research. You've got a major research station there. Do we have any sense of how the research operations at the seashore will be impacted?
Yeah, I think we're getting an idea, although we don't know specifically. We do know that we have a 5% budget reduction scheduled, which I'm sure you've been talking about, but we don't specifically know what will be monitored, or really do we understand, you know, what those short or long-term impacts of those reductions might be. And so I think it's important to note here that you know, the scientists here at the Seashore provide leadership expertise and science support for the Seashore, and it impacts day-to-day operations for certain.
Okay. Well, Jason, thank you so much for updating us on what's going on at the Cape Cod National Seashore. And we will, of course, hope that we do manage to avoid the worst of this and that we will still be able to enjoy the seashore as normal. We also have Dana on the line from Wellfleet. Dana, are you there?
Hi. Thank you very much. As a lover of science and a real believer of in the National Seashore and the staffing needed for it, I'd like to make a political statement about all of what I'm hearing, and that is we always seem to have money for war, especially to fund factions overseas, which later drag us into quagmires, like Iraq, for example, Afghanistan. But we don't have funding for real immediate needs. I think there's some powerful lobbying going on in Washington when science has to get its funding cut in research, and seashore protection has to get its funding cut while we send money to certain factions of Syria in that bloody conflict. We don't even know who we're supporting there.
Now, Dana, I think this goes to the point that Chris Martinson was making earlier about the need to make some real decisions about our national priorities and where, putting our money where our mouths are. Chris Martinson, you have made a transition in your own personal life from being a scientist and then, as you said, going into the tech sector and then really leaving science to become an economist and an economic analyst. How did that prioritization, for you fall out in terms of where science stands in our economy?
Well, Heather, this is a really important subject for me. There are two things any culture or society needs to be truly sustainable. The first is a deep knowledge of how their resource flows and local ecology actually function so that human activities can safely live within the local parameters, whatever those happen to be. And the second thing is you need a cultural story or a narrative that allows those understandings to exist in actual practice. Knowing is not sufficient in this story. You actually have to put that knowledge into practice. So science provides us with the knowledge and tools to make the right decisions. Technology gives us the appropriate tools to put that into practice. But whether we choose to adopt that information and those tools, that's another matter altogether. And right now, we are still fully on an unsustainable path, both economically and ecologically. And that's what myself, many other dedicated people these days, are trying to illuminate. It's a job which is getting easier as more and more people see for themselves in their daily lives, confirmed in the news, that something here is going wrong, and it's in such a large way that mere policy tweaks in D.C. cannot address the actual predicament. So in my own case, it's really a matter of, as Dana was alluding, that we have to really start selecting our priorities, and I'm worried that sequestration is just one of many recent examples that says maybe our priorities are not in alignment with what I am seeing in the world around me today.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for your call. Chris, when you say that our economy is on an unsustainable track, I think this word unsustainable often gets thrown around and means a lot of different things. Can you give us a clearer definition of what you mean by on an unsustainable track?
Oh, certainly, Heather. Quite simply, we have adopted for ourselves an economic system that utterly requires continual growth, and not just any type of growth, but exponential growth. As long as our economy can grow exponentially forever, it's going to do just fine. However, it turns out we live on a finite planet with finite resources, and so our economic system has a gigantic design flaw at its core. And it's not just the U.S. economy. Every economy across the globe that relies on debt-based money, that is money that's loaned into existence, which everybody does these days, all have that same flaw. Again, when these economies can constantly grow, they perform miracles in terms of increasing standards of living and providing technological advancements, but these same economies perform equally terribly when growth is taken away. They literally dissolve without growth. Jobs are lost, dreams dashed, budgets shredded. What was once possible is suddenly impossible. And so my definition of unsustainable relies on this. We have an economy that is wedded to perpetual exponential growth, and as long as it stays within that construct, it literally has no chance of being a fully sustainable economy.
Well, is there a chance that sequestration could be the wake-up call that we need to start getting our economy onto a more sustainable trajectory?
I think it's absolutely a wake-up call. We've had several shots across the bow recently. Many of them have been resisted so far in terms of our national dialogue opening up the idea that something has fundamentally changed. In 2008, we had that first shot across the bow. We came very close to systemic failure at that point. It was actually, if you dig into it, quite a frightening moment. And instead of really facing what was frightening about it, we chose to paper over it. That is an approach, but underneath it, what really structurally needed to be examined and changed did not get called to the fore. Sequestration gives us another opportunity to say, hey, we are living beyond our means economically. Sequestration is simply an acknowledgement of that. But we're also living beyond our means ecologically, and we're getting more and more data around that all the time. And so what I'm really hoping to do in my work and you are doing with this program is to start opening up the conversation. We need to at least have a dialogue about what really we're facing here, because many of the things we're facing are not problems which have solutions. They're predicaments, meaning they have outcomes that we now have to manage. And the earlier we start that and the more prudently we approach that, the better off we'll be.
We have just about a minute left, Chris, and I want to ask you, you've made the case that science is an important part of our economy, something that we should prioritize. Is science as an economic sector something that can be a viable sector without growth?
Science absolutely is able to provide us with an incredible amount of detail and articulation and understanding. And science, as you know, it requires that we have a very complex society that exists there. The moving parts, the pieces, the supply chains that are required to simply get the pieces in place so that we can deepen our understanding. What I'm trying to preserve here is the idea that we do need an economy. It needs to be very complex. But if we wed ourselves to an economy that is either growing or failing, then we run the risk that at some point our economy will fail. And when it does, what was possible before is no longer possible. I am really hoping that we can preserve not just the science and technology we have, but preserve the ability to enhance and expand that. And in order to do that, we really have to understand what makes an economy function, where the risks are, and that we have built for ourselves a type of economy that's really binary. It either does well or very badly, and I would love to avoid the poor outcome, which we can still do.
Chris Martinson is the founder of peakprosperity.com. Chris, thanks for a very informative conversation.
Heather, the pleasure's been mine. Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.